Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Coming to you live today, November 16th, 2008, on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking about spin and public relations and all that goes on behind the news to influence what we see and hear. And joining us will be two of the experts in the area from the Center for Media and Democracy, the publishers of PR Watch, and much other great work we'll be talking about throughout the hour. But before we go to our lesson in spin, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Somewhat lost amidst all the news of the presidential election was a major decision that will have a significant impact on the wireless industry. The Federal Communications Commission approved the $28 billion sale of rural wireless provider Altel to Verizon Wireless. The deal gives Verizon the most subscribers of any U.S. carrier. Joel Kelsey, policy analyst for Consumers Union, says many in the public interest community and on Capitol Hill raised serious questions about what the merger would mean for rural consumers.
In this era of financial turmoil, the FCC was very quick to put this on kind of the rocket docket and make sure that it happened. We believe that, you know, although there's financial uncertainty in the market, you really need to weigh consumers' rights when you're looking at mergers like this. And the fact that we're about to go from 5 to 4 wireless carriers in the nation is something that's alarming.
One of the greatest fears about the merger concerns roaming, the ability to use your wireless service when traveling outside the coverage area of your home network. Altel provided their small rural competitors with good roaming service. Verizon doesn't have that same track record when it comes to allowing roaming to potential competitors.
If they start canceling their roaming contracts and don't allow the other rural, smaller wireless carriers to deal with them or carry service over their network, what used to be Altel's network and is now Verizon's network, then those folks could be in a very difficult place and have to go out of business and shut its doors to some of its subscribers. And that means that they have even less choice in the marketplace.
One of the conditions of the merger is that Verizon must honor Altel's voice roaming deals for 4 years. But the commission did not make the same demand for data roaming.
In this age, when many consumers are looking to wireless to provide data connections, it seems like their options are going to be limited to Verizon and AT&T and some of the other very big wireless carriers. And some of these smaller rural carriers just won't be able to play in the game.
Another condition of the merger is forcing Verizon Altel to divest some of the spectrum they own in several markets. Those airwaves could likely be gobbled up by AT&T.
So now you have Verizon, the number 2 mobile carrier in America, merging with the number 5 to become the largest wireless carrier in the United States. And then the current number 1, soon to be number 2, AT&T, gobbling up all the leftovers. So it just seems that these companies are getting bigger and bigger and consumers are faced with less and less choices.
When the Federal Communications Commission opened the door for more media consolidation in 2007, one of the main supporting arguments came from the National Association of Broadcasters. The NAB said that the public was turning to the internet as a supplement and replacement to traditional television. But a new Nielsen study shows that the broadcasters had it wrong. It turns out consumers aren't using the web as a substitute to traditional TV watching, but as a complement. In fact, the study found that those who use the internet the most actually watch even more TV than those who do not use the internet. Free Press Policy Coordinator Adam Lin says that Nielsen's media research clearly shows that people are still receiving most of their news from traditional sources like TV and newspapers.
People who use the most internet of any of the people they studied also watch the most television. And so we haven't come to a point where the internet's serving as a replacement for the overwhelming majority of people over television in any entertainment as well as news. I mean, people are diversifying the sources they get for information, but they're not replacing one with another. They're just adding.
Lin says the Nielsen findings align with a Free Press study done last year that was filed with the FCC.
We showed that at most someone who uses the internet for an hour reduces their viewing of local news over television by about 90 seconds.
Big media companies have long painted a picture of hyper-competition in the market and say they need to take advantage of the synergy that is produced by consolidating media businesses like newspaper and television and radio stations.
If you allow two companies who are central to gathering news in a local place combine, the first thing they're going to do is the synergies they talk about are firing journalists and making one journalist cover what used to be two journalists' job, and then you get one less viewpoint coming out. The primary goal is to extract as much revenue from that media market as possible and to do as little as possible to get that maximum amount of revenue, which is not what we can have when it comes to providing citizens with information.
For more information about media consolidation, go to stopbigmedia.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're talking about public relations, about spin, and when you're going to that subject, there's no place better to go than the Center for Media and Democracy, based up in Madison, Wisconsin. Its executive director and co-founder, John Stauber, has been a guest on our program many times, and he's spoken widely and written widely with his collaborator Sheldon Rampton on issues of public relations. Today we're fortunate to have two of the key researchers from the Center for Media and Democracy joining us on our program. We're going to start right now with Judith Sears-Poisson, the associate director, who has been active in a lot of the work of the center. Welcome to Media Matters, Judith.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.
Well, it's really a pleasure to have you here. I'm well aware of the center. I think anyone who works in the realm of media activism or media research knows about the center. But I think it's one of those groups like public relations itself that possibly isn't that well known because a lot of the work it does is, you know, sort of deep work.
Right.
What do you give a little bit of what the history of the Center for Media and Democracy is and what it does?
Sure. Well, the Center for Media and Democracy started in Madison, Wisconsin 15 years ago. John Stauber had been an activist on many different issues and at that point was working with Wisconsin small farmers countering Monsanto push for BGH, the bovine growth hormone, that farmers who were not using it would not be allowed to label their products as not having this added hormone. Mm-hmm. Monsanto knew, of course, that a consumer faced with 2 gallons of milk, one that says not treated with bovine growth hormone, the other not saying anything, very likely would pick the one that says it's not treated with this extra hormone, and Monsanto wanted to prevent that. So John was organizing with dairy farmers in Wisconsin, Wisconsin being a big dairy state, and found out that at a large meeting that he had pulled together of people working on this issue across the country, that there was someone there who was actually sent by Monsanto, basically a corporate spy. And going through the list of people that were at the meeting, there was only one person that no one else knew. And it turned out that this woman who had posed as a concerned mom and housewife in, I believe, New Jersey, was actually a plant for Monsanto and was working for them through a PR firm that Burson Marsteller, which Monsanto had hired to infiltrate and co-opt the work that John was doing. And so on a very personal level, John realized that there was this whole other kind of shadow world of public relations that was out there and was affecting probably most issues that people cared about and that no one knew about. So he decided to start the center 15 years ago. Sheldon Rampton joined him very soon after, and their first effort was to put out a quarterly publication called PR Watch.
Which is still in existence?
It is still in existence. We've changed it a little bit in the last year or so. It used to be very journally. We would actually break news in it. But as I'm sure you can appreciate, with the advent of the internet being where people get a lot of their news and also where we can post things instantaneously, it would be... I can't even imagine a situation where something would first break in print anymore. So we do a lot of our reporting on our prwatch.org site, and then we do publish PR Watch as kind of a guide to the reporting that we're doing online. So for close to the first 10 years of CMD's existence, it was basically John and Sheldon, and then a halftime person working in the office and doing some research, Laura Miller, who I know you know. And then a little over 5 years ago, John decided that, you know, the mission of the center was so important that it really needed to be an independent organization that didn't depend on him or Sheldon to continue and to thrive. And so he very consciously decided to grow the center. And luckily, there were funders available who wanted to help him do that. And the center doesn't accept any corporate, government, or labor union grants. So it's all from individuals and from foundations. And so today, we're actually a staff of 10 people.
Wow.
Yeah, which is surprising. We're spread all over. We have our SourceWatch editor, and we definitely should talk about our SourceWatch project, but he's actually based in Hobart, Tasmania, Australia. Mm-hmm. We have a Tobacco Wiki editor who's based in Colorado, and our Congresspedia editor is based in Washington, D.C., not surprisingly.
Well, on that note, let's turn to the senior researcher who's joining us now on the phone line from Madison, who's been a guest on this program before, Diane Farsetta, who's done a lot of work on especially, but not exclusively, the rise of video news releases, the use of fake news, and exposing that and really making it a national issue. Diane Farsetta has a PhD in biology, so we know she's a smart person. Before joining the Center for Media and Democracy, Diane, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you on. And how long have you been at the center?
I've been a little bit more than 5 years. So I was able to watch a lot of the growth that Judith was just talking about, and it's been really exciting.
You know, I think some of our listeners might not be familiar with the video news release phenomenon and the growth of fake news and the work that you spearheaded doing the research at the center over the past few years. Would you mind just giving a brief summary of that?
Oh, sure. As we were talking about earlier, the Center for Media and Democracy focuses on, I really think of our program work in having two different approaches. Sometimes we look at a particular issue and we'll follow that and look at that and report on that in terms of how has this been shaped, how has news coverage of it been shaped by hidden interests through PR firms and other sort of nefarious actors who tend to stay in the shadows but have a very big impact. The other part of what we do is to look at sort of tactics that are used by PR people and people trying to shift the public discourse on important issues. So I would say our work on video news releases really fits into looking at a tactic, and a very deceptive tactic. What video news releases, or VNRs, what they are, is short videos. They're usually, you know, 1 to 2 minutes long. They can either be a completely prepackaged, scripted video that looks exactly like a news report. So you'll have someone coming on saying, this patient was having problems with their breathing until this new wonder drug from pharmaceutical company X came on the market. And these are actually aired in news programming, in television news programs. The problem is they come from PR firms. They are sponsored to highlight the products or to burnish the public image of companies that fund these segments. But overwhelmingly, the vast majority of the time, they're put on the airwaves by TV news programs or TV news operations that have limited budgets and without any disclosure to viewers that actually...
Diane Farsetta, that's got to be illegal, isn't it?
Well, it depends on how you read the law. How we read the law is that it is actually illegal not to disclose these. There is the Federal Communications Commission. One of its many important rules is the sponsorship identification requirements. And I know, and I've been on your show before, we've talked about that and how similar it is to the payola statutes. But, you know, so we say, yes, you know, this is illegal to put out their sponsored broadcast material without letting your viewers or your listeners, this also happens in radio, called audio news releases, without letting them know who paid for this and you know, obviously whose interests it's serving. And we brought this. What we did is we did three reports about video news releases, tracking these videos that come out from the PR firms, looking to see which TV stations are airing them and whether or not there's any disclosure to viewers.
Now, these are just a few crackpot stations in Appalachia, aren't they? This isn't going on very often, and I'm sure after your report now that's all stopped, right?
Oh, if only it were so, but no. And we actually found some 111 stations that then we brought to the attention of the FCC that this is going on, and it includes major stations, the largest stations in the country, and in New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Chicago and Milwaukee, and so all over the place. You know, these are going on, and it's really something that's become part of the economic model, unfortunately, for a lot of television newsrooms, is just to rely on these. We were very happy, very gratified when the FCC launched an investigation, its first investigation into video news releases based on our report, and that happened last year. And just about last year this time, the FCC announced its first fines ever against one of the companies, Comcast, because their cable channel, CNET, was one of the stations that we had found airing VNRs without any disclosure. And that's where it stayed since then. So
was the fine $10?
Oh, no. It was, I believe it was $4,000 per incident for three incidents. So okay. Not very much for Comcast, but, you know, we'll take it. It's better than nothing.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Diane Farsetta, you've just been listening to, the senior researcher at the Center for Media and Democracy. Also with us here in our mobile studio, Judith Sears-Poisson, the associate director for the Center for Media and Democracy. The center is based in Madison. It publishes the journal PR Watch. They have a huge website with a number of resource-rich pages at prwatch.org. A weekly radio show we'll be talking about, and a huge contest we'll be talking about, the Falsies, which is sort of an ironic award for the most deceptive PR going in the country. We'll be talking about quite a bit. If you have questions or comments for Judith Sears-Poisson or Diane Farsetta, please call us here at WILL AM 580. Our phone number 333-9455. Our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And again, I'm Bob McChesney, your host. This is a show I've been looking forward to for a long time, Judith, because public relations spin is something, if you study media like I do, just as your both mm-hmm. your stories talk about, you don't go very far into the news before you head into the trough of public relations and spin. And, you know, when you're talking to someone who doesn't know anything about this, mm-hmm. and I assume most people you deal with don't know much about it, and they say, well, give me an example. Do you have, like, one or two, like, really striking stories? Here's an example of how it works, this for the layperson.
I think that, you know, depending on what area of interest someone has, there are really striking examples that they've probably run into and have certainly taken it in and maybe not waited as much as they should. And you kind of see that aha moment when you mm-hmm. talk about it. One of the things that I've written on quite extensively is the PR, the politics and PR of cervical cancer and the Gardasil vaccination that's been pushed for first women, then young women, then very young girls, and now they're actually talking about it for boys as well. And I wrote a four-article series last year called The Politics and PR of Cervical Cancer, and basically lays out how Merck knew that they had this window of opportunity where they would have the only HPV, human papillomavirus, vaccination available in the U.S. They still have a corner on the market. The competitor from GlaxoSmithKline has been significantly delayed. And how they poured millions of dollars into a campaign that I think it would be almost impossible to avoid if you've spent even any time in the U.S. in the last few years, let alone live here. Mm-hmm. And what I laid out in the articles is how they used the PR firm Edelman, who has a long and sordid history of working with a variety of different industries, including big tobacco. So not necessarily always on what could be seen as the right side of the health issue, certainly. And basically how Merck paid for and very carefully laid out this series of ads that began even before their vaccine, Gardasil, was approved by the FDA, to create this culture of fear and panic about women's health, women's and girls' health, mm-hmm. and how it's been shorthanded to be called a vaccine against cervical cancer, which is a vast oversimplification of it. But it's gotten to the point where if you have a daughter who is in the middle school, high school, young college age, as I do, you're almost seen as negligent if you haven't rushed off to buy this very expensive series of shots, which there's very little evidence that, in fact, there's no evidence that it will, in fact, prevent cervical cancer down the line because there hasn't been enough testing. And we're giving girls a series of shots before they're sexually active, they may need a booster shot. And this is all about the bottom line for Merck, and Merck trying to pay for their debacle of Vioxx, where their painkiller was actually killing a lot of people. So I think that something like that, where you say, look, you know, have you heard about this vaccine? And they say, oh, yeah, you know, I've seen the I Want to Be One Less and, you know, movie trailers, ads in magazines, TV ads, especially during those prime hours of like Oprah and The View when they figure a lot of women are watching. They've really played on a genuine desire of parents to protect their children and a genuine desire of young women to feel like they're empowered and in control of their lives to sell a product that is not necessarily in their best interest.
Thank you very much, Judith Sears-Basson. Diane Farsetta, you know, lots of people do public relations. The Red Cross does it. Battered women shelters do it. All sorts of institutions do it. Why is your organization so critical of public relations?
Right, and I always think it's important to point out that not all PR is bad PR. For me, and I think for the Center for Media and Democracy as a whole, a lot of it comes down to disclosure. You know, and there's nothing, you know, particularly nefarious about wanting to get your viewpoint in the news. You know, all of us do that. But it's a matter of where does it cross that line when you're putting forward people that you claim are unrelated to your company, you know, what's called the third-party tactic in PR speak that, you know, for example, I've done a lot of writing about the nuclear industry, and they have one of their premier spokespeople now is Patrick Moore, who's a former Greenpeace activist turned PR consultant, and he goes around the country. He was just here in Madison, Wisconsin, and he presents himself as a Greenpeace activist, former Greenpeace activist, who supports nuclear industry without saying that he's a PR consultant for the Nuclear Energy Institute, the main trade association for nuclear industry companies in the United States. So that's sort of where it comes down, is just saying, you know, look, it's fine to have your voice. It's fine to try and get your viewpoint, information that you think is important into the news, but you need to respect that. And we often talk about the pollution of our information environment. You know, it's important to respect, really, the editorial process, to respect the fact that news media are where we understand what's going on in the world, you know, whether it's in our backyard or halfway across the globe. That's how we try and understand as citizens of a democracy what's going on and what we think, you know, should happen on any given issue. And if, you know, as often unfortunately happens, you have deep-pocketed corporations that are twisting that dialogue, they're twisting that source of information to their benefit in ways that are not obvious, that are not disclosed, that are not ethical by any standard, then that's the problem, and that's what we concentrate on.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. This is WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. You've just been listening to Diane Farsetta, a senior researcher for the Center for Media and Democracy, which is based in Madison, Wisconsin. With us also in our mobile studio today is the associate director of the Center for Media and Democracy, Judith Sears-Basson. We're talking about the work of the center, which publishes PR Watch and has the huge website with an immense amount of material and resources at prwatch.org. Produces a weekly radio show and has a major contest, annual contest it does, called The Falsies. I guess yeah. I guess the FCC will let me say that without getting in hot water. Judith, talk a little bit, if you would, about The Weekly Spin, the radio program that you've launched and what it covers and how you come up with the stories.
Absolutely. And Diane and I are the two that do produce The Weekly Radio Spin every week. It's a short 5-minute segment. It's available to any radio stations who would like to use it, and also available as a weekly podcast, and people can go to prwatch.org/audio, and they will find past editions of it and also be able to sign up for it. Diane was really the impetus behind us getting it started just a little over a year ago. We did our first one. In fact, further back, Laura Miller, when she worked with the center, had done a pretty bare-bones weekly radio spin that was actually picked up on quite a few community and low-power stations. When Laura left, it kind of went into hiatus. Some people that liked it a lot actually picked up the banner and did it themselves based on our weekly spin email. And then we were able to take it back under CMD's umbrella last year. And so basically, we look at the reporting that's been done on our own website in the last week, prwatch.org. We do both original reporting, and we also point to important articles that we find in a variety of places, everything from, you know, The Guardian to The Wall Street Journal to trade publications like Advertising Age, O'Dwyer's PR. And we always try to look at the issues through that spin lens, because there are a lot of stories that are out there that have a spin angle that are not being talked about, even if the story itself is being talked about widely. So we really focus on that both in our reporting and in the weekly radio spin. So we usually do about four or five very short segments, often with a little outside audio to emphasize a point. And then we do 6 degrees of spin and fakin, where we connect media manipulators.
Okay. Diane Farsetta, are there examples of when you guys have been able to break some stories, maybe on the weekly spin or elsewhere, where then journalists have had to change the way they've covered stories because of the work you've done?
Well, that's what we always drive for. That's definitely part of our goal. And I think that we have had some impact. I mean, just recently, we were able, through our SourceWatch website, which is PR Watch, is sort of our, prwatch.org is our website for reporting. The SourceWatch.org website is more of a collaborative wiki-based website where we say it's an encyclopedia of people, issues, and groups shaping the public agenda. We've had up on our SourceWatch website for at least several months now sort of a notice profiling this person, Martin Eisenstadt, who sort of portrayed he's a hoax, basically. He doesn't exist. There's a blog put up in his name. He says he's a right-wing, you know, think tank fellow. He identified himself as part of the John McCain campaign and sort of put out various sort of misleading but juicy tidbits that sometimes got reported even by major media, you know, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, as news. The New York Times actually just recently looked at this. Martin Eisenstadt took the credit for leaking to the news that Sarah Palin thought that Africa was maybe a country and not a continent. So, you know, that claim or her supposed lack of knowledge about Africa, you know, was not the hoax. The hoax was this person, Martin Eisenstadt, who doesn't exist, claiming that he leaked it. Anyhow, so on our SourceWatch website, we've outed him for a while, and the New York Times actually pointed to SourceWatch and said, you know, if these major media had even done their fact-checking in terms of, you know, pulling out the SourceWatch website, they would have seen that this person does not exist.
So, Judith Sears-Poisson, you outed this Martin Eisenstadt. We still don't know who this guy is, do we?
No. What's important, and unfortunately, even the New York Times didn't do as much as they could have to kind of clear this up. It's kind of a fake. So he was saying that he was the top advisor in the McCain campaign, and that that the information was coming from him, that Sarah Palin didn't know whether Africa was a country or continent, or maybe both, or maybe neither. In fact, it hasn't been disproven that that's the case, that she might have thought that. The only thing that's in doubt is
she didn't deny that.
She didn't deny it. And in fact, if you watch a clip of her, what she's saying is that if somebody wants to malign her, they should not do it anonymously. And she said something like about the country or continent of Africa, whatever, I think was almost an exact quote. So, you know, all of a sudden now the right-wing media is saying, oh, you know, just another example of how Sarah Palin is being unfairly maligned, blah blah blah. In fact, it's still not clear at all that she knew what Africa is. What's not clear is who actually first put that information out there.
And this is incredibly sloppy reporting, isn't it, Diane Farsetta? Just out of the blue, some reckless charge is just delivered, and people publish it or broadcast it.
Right. It is, and it's you know, you do learn a lot about reading the trade press, the public relations and marketing trade press, looking at when there are these slip-ups in reporting. You do learn a lot about the shortfalls of news operations. And that's exactly what PR people are doing too. And they're using that, you know, when it's a story that's just great, you know, it's juicy, reporters want it to be true almost, there's less fact-checking that goes on in general, you know, in those cases. And that's how Martin Eisenstadt was able, you know, quote-unquote, this hoax person, was able to get a number of juicy stories into the media that weren't actually real.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. It's WILL AM 580. We're talking with Judith Sears-Poisson and Diane Farsetta from the Center for Media and Democracy, the folks who do the weekly spin, PRWatch.org, the big contest, the falsies we'll be talking about, SourceWatch, Congresspedia. The website is a veritable goldmine of information on how public relations work, what's being done, and sort of exposing practices that regrettably far too few Americans are familiar with. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for either of our guests, the number here at WILL is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Judith, what's this Falsies Award all about?
The Falsies are kind of a fun end-of-year look back at the spin and propaganda that we've been tracking. You know, I think that it's kind of natural, both professionally and personally, that, you know, the end of the year seems like a good time for reflection and looking back. And what we like to do is, you know, we're certainly working on these issues all day, every day, but we like to get input from people who do visit our websites, who get our publications, and find out what really, you know, struck a nerve with them. So the staff put some time in kind of putting together a ballot of what we see as the worst of the worst from the year.
If I can interrupt here for a second, as I go through the ballot, and I urge listeners to do it, because what you've done in a way is compile nine of the most egregious examples of how spin have affected our news and our media and our culture this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's not ancient history about
talking. Oh no, it's all this year.
Yeah. We spun the way into Spanish-American War or something.
No.
This is happening right now.
Although and we probably did.
It's almost like the greatest hits of contemporary spin. So this is a really nice place, I think, for listeners to go at prwatch.org. You can click right through to the falsies to see sort of the top nine.
Just look for the Groucho glasses.
Okay, and Diane Farsetta, let's talk about a couple of these, go through a few of these, because they really are quite extraordinary. Number one on the ballot this year for the Falsies Award as the top supreme subverter of the free flow of information is the Propaganda Pundits. And again, this is a huge story that the Center's been working on for years. And Americans have heard a little bit about this. It occasionally gets in the news, and we've certainly talked about it on this program, but I think it's still largely lost in the shuffle. What is that?
Right, I definitely agree with that. The Propaganda Pundits, it refers to what we also call the Pentagon Pundit Program. It's very alliterative. And what this is back in early 2002, the Defense Department under then Undersecretary of Defense Tory Clark, former PR professional, decided that, well, what we need is some quote-unquote message force multipliers. Some people, you know, I mentioned the third-party tactic earlier. We need some people who aren't in the Defense Department, who are public figures, who people trust, to go out there and basically advocate for the invasion of Iraq. And that's what they did. And they set up this program. It's more than 75 retired military officers who also served as media commentators on security issues, on, you know, sort of international military issues. These people were brought into the fold of the Pentagon. They were flattered. They were given high-level access to Pentagon officials. They were given talking points. They were given help from Pentagon PR people as they were drafting op-ed pieces. And these people, they went and they basically parroted the administration's line that on Iraq, but not just on Iraq, also on Guantanamo Bay, on warrantless wiretapping, on the war in Afghanistan. So this was a really involved, massive propaganda, and there's no other word for it. It's a propaganda operation that no one still has been held accountable for. And major kudos go to the New York Times for outing this in, I believe it was April of this year. They exposed it, and we've done a lot of work reporting on it, pointing out another aspect of the story, which is a lot of these Pentagon pundits also work for military contractors. They're either lobbyists or consultants for military contractors. So they were very much profiting off of that high-level Pentagon access they had through the program.
Let's go to the phone lines now. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently to get on the air with Diane Farsetta, who you just heard, and Judith Sears-Poisson, who's joining me here in the mobile studio. Let's go now to line one. Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, I just had two comments to make. One is a very simple question. I would be interested to know when the term spin in the present sense got into use, because I don't remember it. As an old duffer, I don't remember it being used back in the 50s, so I just wondered when it took its rise. The other thing is that I must say that I find listening to this character, Bill O'Reilly, very amusing, because he starts out by saying this is the no-spin zone, when, in fact, that's all it is spin, the Bill O'Reilly spin. And, you know, I almost fall off my chair laughing because, you know, it reminds me of Orwell's distortion of the language where you call peace war and war peace and so on and so forth, to say this is the no-spin zone when that's exactly what it is, strikes me as I don't know whether it's grotesque or hilarious or what it is, but, well, maybe you can deal with those.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Judith, you want to start with the term spin, or you want to lob that to your compatriot?
I would be happy to have Diane answer if she'd like to. Otherwise, I could also talk a little bit about Eddie Bernays, if that makes sense. Diane?
Sure. I mean, I offhand, I don't know when spin became a very widespread term to refer to PR and to deceptive. I would say it's at least been a few decades now, you know, going back to the birth of the modern public relations industry, and that really coming out of the world wars, especially World War I, you know, and then you have Eddie Bernays and Walter Lippmann, and there was a lot of talk about propaganda, and actually Bernays' seminal book is called Propaganda. You know, and that's something that's a much more charged word, I think, today than it was then. It became so, I think, after World War II and sort of awareness of the German propaganda and that being associated. Not that there wasn't Allied propaganda, but of course the word propaganda was repeatedly used to refer to the bad guys, you know, to refer to Germany and Japan, and that's when that really went out of vogue. And yeah, I think spin, you know, sort of rose after that. So over the past few decades.
Okay. Judith, you have something to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a little more about Eddie Bernays, because I think he's just a fascinating character. Edward Bernays, and if people are interested, it's Bernays, not like the sauce. He was actually the nephew, the double nephew, because of some very close marriages between his mother's and father's families. He was the double nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he definitely saw himself as taking a lot of Uncle Sigmund's ideas about psychology and what motivates people, and using it in his practice. He became one of the very first PR practitioners, and proudly so. And what we see through the trajectory of his life, and then where the public relations industry went after his career, is that it really did come out of World War I and the necessity to sell a very reticent U.S. public on getting involved in this European war. What the people like Eddie Bernays, who worked on behalf of the government in that effort, realized is that if they can be so successful selling war to people, they can also use it to sell a whole lot of other things to people. And so the whole idea of corporate spin was developed and really became a very lucrative profession. One of the things that Eddie Bernays did was convince women that smoking was okay. It had been very taboo for women to smoke, and he actually organized a group kind of a la the suffragettes to march proudly down the streets of New York smoking away. And these were upper society women. And that was a really big taboo that was broken. And suddenly, it wasn't taboo for women to smoke. It was a sign of empowerment. And so what we've seen then was this huge growth of the corporate PR industry, which now we're seeing is also being used very effectively in the propaganda field to sell wars and occupation. So the field of PR has really come full circle. and is completely necessary for both selling products to people, but also selling concepts like invading other countries to the American public or any public.
Well, let me go back to you, Diane, and talk about the second half of the questioner's call, which referred to the Bill O'Reilly show and his sort of ironic use of the term no spin zone. That sort of leads to another question. Is this sort of spin, like the caller identifies O'Reilly, is this done pretty much exclusively by conservative commentators, or is spin cut across the political spectrum?
I think spin does cut across the political spectrum, and a lot of what we watchdog at the Center for Media and Democracy, we don't, we're nonpartisan. We'll look wherever spin goes. But, you know, for the most part, where is spin? Spin is where you have an entrenched interest with a lot of money to spend on PR and an unpopular thing, basically, that they're trying to sell or they're trying to foist on the public. So a lot of the time, that is major corporations that, you know, are trying to get their policy agendas passed or trying to get away with polluting neighborhoods or trying to get away with bailouts, corporate bailouts, or whatever it is. So a lot of what we do doesn't necessarily fall into the left versus right, but it falls into the corporate versus grassroots perspective.
Let's go back to the phone lines now to another caller who's been waiting patiently to speak with Judith Sears-Poisson, Diane Farsetta from the Center for Media and Democracy. Line 2, Champaign County, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Hi. Regarding this, the hoaxer, I think out of NPR West, I heard an interview with the guy that was admitting to doing it, and maybe that was a hoax, too. On the category of what I'm calling Rovian hoaxes, Rove, as an election consultant, was very early on, I think it was a state race in Texas, where the allegation is that he purposefully leaked an impeachable source of a true fact. This is a little different than the suspicious source of the Palin remark. But the idea is just to play the game at a meta level and to be talking about the media's irresponsibility instead of the true nature of the fact. And obviously the Lollapalooza of that category is the fake release of the thing to Dan Rather, where everyone was talking about that. So that's a bit of a digression. It's a little old history, I guess, but I think it bears some reminding. The Weapons of Mass Deception book, I'm away from electronics momentarily here, so...
Oh, how can you survive?
Well, the phone and the radio does fine when you're on, Bob.
You serve as an IV for the time being.
Yeah. So, I'm trying to remember the name of the ex-CIA head who was involved in a lobbying firm and was also involved in the campaign to start the Iraq War. And I know that Rampton and crew did, and maybe one of these persons was doing the research for that book too, but this elaborate connection between PR, lobbyists, and government money, I mean, some of this money that this firm was getting was actually... laundered money from the CIA. So the CIA was paying the salary of this ex-CIA guy to... somebody must remember the name of the guy. He's nominally a Democrat and was in Clinton's first CIA head. So, but that's sort of, I think, another such a major story where it's not simply the corporations, but it's also the government. And you did get at that a little bit with the idea of the generals, but I think I'd like to hear a little more on that and appreciate all the work that PR Watch does. So.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Judith, you want to bat first? No. Diane, I think you get to bat first here.
Right. And, you know, I agree with a lot of what the caller was saying. I mean, one of the, to speak first to Eisenstadt, I did read that, you know, the people who said they created Eisenstadt were two filmmakers who said they wanted to develop this person as a character to use in their videos. And, you know, as far as the Rovian tactics, yeah, shift the conversation is a great way, both in political campaigns and in PR campaigns. If you know something is a weakness, you shift the conversation away from that, or you neutralize. And I think this is what happened, you know, 4 years ago. You neutralize your opponent's strengths. And what I referred to 4 years ago is going against John Kerry with this smear tactic of actually calling into question his Vietnam service, which, of course, George Bush did not have. As far as the CIA person, you know, I'm not sure offhand who the name of that person, but I'm sure what the caller was referring to is the broader operation that Iraqi exile Ahmad Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress, which was funded for years and years by the CIA. It actually was established by a PR firm, and basically, again, to sell the war in Iraq.
You know, let me go back, if I can, to the falsies, and I'm going through this list of the top 10. And again, I want to urge listeners to go to prwatch.org and click through on falsies and look at this list, because it's really a compendium of some of the most extraordinary public relations. And number six on the list, excuse me, is the Center for Consumer Fiefdom, and refers to the work of a corporate lobbyist named Rick Berman. And we'll talk a little bit about that, because this guy seems to be this guy should be better known based on his resume that I'm reading about here. He's involved in several. This guy's got more groups, you know, than the Communist Party had back in the 30s. Do you want to talk a little bit about this, Judith?
Sure. Rick Berman, we're actually proposing that this year alone might get him a Lifetime Achievement Award. he really, and people might remember, he was actually profiled on 60 Minutes, I believe, in about the last year or so. Maybe it's a little longer than I'm thinking.
Thought PR people didn't like to be publicized, though.
You know, he's an interesting guy. He's very unabashed about what he does and why he does it.
Really want to win the falsie this year.
I know, you know, and you know, we're thinking maybe we'll have to hand deliver the award. he's an interesting person too, because he is a corporate lobbyist, but then he also sets up these front groups, otherwise known as AstroTurf, which might seem strange at first, but when you think about grassroots being the authentic voice of the people, AstroTurf has the appearance of grassroots, but is actually has very little in common with real grassroots. And so he sets up front groups that are corporate funded, and surprise, surprise, push for the agenda of the corporations that are funding them. So one of his best known groups is the Center for Consumer Freedom. It's funded by alcohol, tobacco, fast food, basically, you know, the people that make a lot of money off of Americans' bad eating habits, smoking, drinking, and the like. And so the Center for Consumer Freedom has fought a lot of things, including the pushes in various municipalities to have nutrition information posted.
Well, time out. I got to ask you about this. Just sure. Center for Consumer Freedom.
See,
is there like a Federal Trade Commission?
Right. Well, and who's against freedom, especially for consumers? I mean, that's kind of what Diane was saying. You know, if you can portray yourself or portray what the debate should be about as being exactly opposite of what you're standing for, you come out a lot better. Yeah. If it was the Center for Corporations' bottom lines, it probably wouldn't be nearly as effective. So as their pit bull, and he really is a very aggressive person, he has really tried to fight through Center for Consumer Freedom against having nutritional disclosure policies put on menus, say, in New York. He has really fought against the trans fat issue, that trans fats are very bad for your health. And he's Center for Consumer Freedom will happily pass along kind of the one-off, slightly hard to believe studies that say things like, oh, actually, you know, obesity might be caused by sleeping in air conditioning. It's not really, because, you know, we're eating five times the calories every day that any human being would need. So Center for Consumer Freedom really focuses on food, beverage issues.
You know, let me ask you, Diane, about Rick Berman. We've barely gotten started on this guy.
Oh, yeah.
he's put together a strong case here. He's also got a group called the Center for Union Facts. And why I think this is especially important, I noticed during the campaign, I didn't see any candidates talking about this, but I periodically noticed these ads calling for, you know, not allowing or on union law. And I was wondering, what's this all about? And apparently, there's a possibility that in the next 6 months or so, we could have a major debate in the United States over whether to make it easier for workers to organize trade unions, something that's virtually impossible to do now in the United States. And I gather Rick Berman's already hard at work on that front.
Right. Yeah. This is something that very much scares Berman and scares his corporate clients who are funding these front groups like the Center for Union Facts. Basically, right there, They've been for years, actually, now, they've been advocating against making unionization easier in the United States, doing the CARD campaign where, you know, you don't have to have, and instead of having an election, which is the time where a lot of corporations will then bring in union-busting firms and intimidate employees, even fire people that are organizing the union in their workplace, what this legislation, which is called the Employee Free Choice Act, what it would do is allow for a more flexible approach that the basically the workplace could decide between, are we going to go to elections or are we going to do a CARD system where people can individually sort of indicate their choice whether they want to be union or not. But, yeah, so this scares Berman, and his clients hate this. And what they've been saying, and this goes to the, you know, sort of say the opposite of reality and just say it often enough and you know, sort of threateningly enough that hopefully you'll scare people into doing whatever you want them to do. They say, well, what this act would really do is it would let the union bosses come to your home and knock down your door and intimidate you and make you join a union. And that's completely wrong. It's a total distortion of what this act does. It's a total distortion of the state of you know, working America. But this is what he gets paid the big.
You know, I saw one of these ads, and they actually hire an actor who had appeared in The Sopranos as a mobster to do the ad. So it's directly out of, you know, on the waterfront sort of interpretation of trade unions in the United States. Quite extraordinary. Our guest today, Diane Farsetta, you've just been listening to, the senior researcher at the Center for Media and Democracy. Also here in the mobile studio, Judith Sears-Poisson, the associate director of the Center for Media and Democracy. We're talking about spin public relations, how it goes on. Go to their terrific website, prwatch.org, where there is just a massive volume of high-quality research and information on a full range of subjects. We have not touched on more than 1%, if that, of the issues. And what we're talking about right now for the remainder of the show are the Falsies, which is their annual contest, and people can vote on it as long as they vote before December 1st, and the award goes to the biggest BS artist in the country for the year. And we're just talking about some of the candidates and some of the issues. And I think what I see as I go through this list, Judith and Diane, is that a lot of the issues that we're seeing in the news, I now see that they're there because someone's paying someone a lot of money to get them there.
Absolutely.
And to get a certain interpretation of it. And one of the ones that became a big story in the political campaign is number 7 on the Falsie nominee list, which is Coal is the New Green. And again, one of these groups, I wonder where they come up with these names, a group, the Americans for Balanced Energy Choices. What's the story there, Judith?
And actually, I'm going to flip that over to Diane, because okay. Diane has done quite a bit of work on the greening of coal.
Yeah, please do. Diane, please take over.
Sure. So basically, this is another front group, and yeah, they always do have these bland, lovely, positive names that don't really say who they are or what they want. But Americans for Balanced Energy Choices is a coal industry front group. There's also Americans for American Power, the Center for Energy and Economic Development, the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. All of these are front groups for the coal industry. And basically, the coal industry is it's an industry that's been sort of put into a corner in a way by the increasing awareness of global warming, the concern about global warming, and the fact that there is no such thing as clean coal. So they realize that there's been dozens of plans for new coal plants that have been rejected, that have been turned down across the country. I think it's definitely in the mid-50s, if not 60-some coal plants that have been turned down in the United States across the country over the past year. So what they're basically fighting for their livelihood. And how do they do that? They don't go, hey, you know, we don't care about global warming. We want to keep on being able to put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. What they do is instead say, well, we want balanced energy choices. We want to promote clean coal. And what this group, the Americans for Balanced Energy Choices, what it's done over the past year to 2 years has really just ramped up its marketing and PR budgets. They had a $35 million ad campaign over the past year saying, you know, there is such a thing as clean coal. We're going to bring it to you. Don't worry about, you know, global warming. Let's just have more coal plants. They co-sponsored, I think it was 6 U.S. presidential debates. They hired people to walk around outside some of the debates, handing out questions that people could ask the presidential candidates, and of course they all put clean coal, quote unquote, on the table. They also tried to.
If I'm not mistaken, Obama came out for clean coal during the campaign, and I would assume that this campaign had something to do with that.
Right. It certainly did, it put the pressure on him. And Illinois is one of the states where it's harder to be from while rejecting the claims of clean coal. So, unfortunately, there is that aspect to it. Edelman is the PR firm that was really behind a lot of this work, the quote-unquote clean coal work.
We don't have a lot of time left, and there's so much more I want to talk about. But one person that shows up in the Falsey award nominee list is someone who came up a lot in the news, Mark Penn, mm-hmm. who was a major figure in Hillary Clinton's campaign for the presidency. And I think he sort of came out because he was sort of shot from the hip and sometimes said stuff that most people thought better left in a bar stool. But he's got a much more interesting history than just being a guy who shoots from the hip, as I judge here. Tell me a little bit about this guy, Mark Penn. Why would he be so interested in helping Hillary Clinton become president?
Sure. Well, Mark Penn is actually the head of one of the largest public relations firms in the world, Burson Marsteller. And he was, as you said, one of Hillary Clinton's chief campaign strategists. The campaign really stayed pretty loyal to Penn long after it seemed like it made sense. It came out that his company actually has a large department which their specialty is working with corporations to do union busting. And of course, Hillary Clinton was counting very heavily on support from the union community, the labor community. So that really was not a good connection. So he tried to backpedal from that and said, well, I don't work in that area at all. But then another actually what...
But my company does.
But my company does. And I'm the head of it, but, I'm holding it at arm's length as much as I can. But what really kind of sunk his attempts to be all things to all people was that Hillary Clinton was very vocally opposed to a free trade agreement with Colombia.
As is Obama.
Right, as is Obama. But unlike Obama, her top campaign strategist, Mark Penn, was actually working for the Colombian government to push for and lobby for exactly that free trade agreement. When it came out that he was obviously playing both sides of this issue, he hedged his bets and thought, well, I don't want to piss off the potential next president of the United States. And he said, oh, yes, that meeting that I had with the Colombian government was definitely a mistake as a way to try to re-ingratiate himself with the Clinton campaign. Unfortunately, the Colombians took that rather badly, and so they immediately canceled their contract with Burson Marsteller over that. Penn was actually forced out of the campaign, quote-unquote, but he basically was still very much part of it. He still was in on the important strategy calls. And his polling firm, of course, a lot of these firms have many different tentacles that are active in very different areas. The polling firm continued to work for Clinton.
Dan Farsetta, we've only got a minute or two left, and I was wondering if there were any particular issues we haven't talked about or candidates in the fall sees that you think are of particular importance that people ought to know about in the world of spin so our listeners can be better aware of what's going on.
Well, I would definitely encourage people to read through the whole list on PRWatch.org. We talk about corporate spying. Judith mentioned that earlier as the original reason that John Stauber founded the Center for Media and Democracy. It's going on today with corporate spies infiltrating gun control groups along with environmental groups, and there's a lot of that going on. That
isn't that illegal?
People.
I mean, I'm just curious. There ought to be a law that say, are you allowed to go work in a gun control group or an environmental group and not disclose that you're being paid by a PR firm to sort of screw up the group?
Yeah, apparently it is very difficult to actually bring that into a court of law, and I don't know the legal details, but it does seem like it should be easier than it actually is.
Yeah, and what about you, Judith? Are there particular stories we've only got a minute left now. Something you want to make sure that we get out over the air?
I think one of the, is actually number 10 on the list, disputing the count of the dead, is something that Diane did a lot of reporting on.
Yeah,
and it's really important that one of the ways that the Iraq War has remained somewhat palatable to the U.S. public is that there has been a very concerted effort to minimize or just simply not report on the vast number of civilian deaths in Iraq. And the fact that something as respected as a British medical journal, The Lancet, would go out against it is really a difficult situation and important to know about.
Oh, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. That was Judith Sears-Bosson, you just heard speaking. We've also been joined by Dan Farsetta over the lines from Madison. I want to thank both of you for joining me today here at Media Matters.
Thanks for having us, Bob. Yeah,
it's been great. Good luck with your work, and I urge our listeners to go to prwatch.org to learn more about the group, vote for the fall season, just get educated on these issues. My name's Bob McChesney. We'll be back at WILL 167 hours from now with John Nichols talking about the current political environment. And I want to thank Colin Cook for sitting in today for Andrew Boyle, doing a great job personing the boards for us. So see you all in 1 week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Today in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a high of 45 degrees. The wind from the northwest-west at 8 to 16 miles per hour with gusts above 20 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy and cold with a few flurries during the overnight hours. The low 28 degrees with wind from the northwest at 8 to 16 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a minimal chance of snow flurries in the morning. The high 37.